Philosophy, a hardbound collection of all the life lessons I've learned.
God is not a Gumby action figure that you can shape any way you want.
Phil, have you gone mental?
Act like men, not like girls.
I've got a real clear message for the two of you on that. Stop doing it.
How about we agree to argue until one of us actually refutes the other?
Are you kidding me?
This is a Too Wretched for Radio. Phil would like to talk to you today about various and sundry stories. Now, we're not going to get into any one of them for a particularly long amount of time, but just a number of things that I would like for you to comment on because they're happening right now. Story number one, now that I finished my apology tour. Phil, we've seen a lot of things in culture that would indicate the fall of America is imminent. I don't think I've ever read a story imminent
with an I.
Imminent, not eminent, yeah. Because if you're eminent, then you'd be like a king, but this is imminent.
Right.
Nevertheless, this is pretty much the end right here. Somebody with apparently a lot of money and free time surveyed Americans asking what's the best Mexican restaurant in the country. And the winner was Taco Bell. Phil, we're just done. We're just done as a country. There's no hope left for America. Taco Bell won the best Mexican restaurant in the country.
Yeah, that's sad.
That's all I'm going to get from you. That's it.
Yeah, that's just sad.
Story number two. Little House on the Prairie author Laura Ingalls Wilder's name is removed from top children's literature honor over her stereotypical attitudes to blacks and Native Americans. I think that Tim Challies jumped on this story. A lot of people wrote in some very thoughtful commentary on it. But Laura Ingalls Wilder, a woman of her time, she said things that today we'd go, that isn't right. Phil, this seems to me to be another one of those stories in the line of, if we find a flaw, particularly a more of the progressive type of flaws, that our current culture really thinks is a really big sin, we find anything about anybody from the past, and they are totally discredited and disqualified. George Washington, Thomas Jefferson. And now Laura Ingalls Wilder, what are we to make of this theme?
Well, it's a reflection of the fact that the current generation, the millennial generation and before, actually, have been working hard to sort of revamp the moral foundation of our culture and our society so that, you know, for example, I mean, the most obvious example would be you determine your gender by how you feel rather than genetically. Whether you're male or female isn't a question of genetics anymore. It's how you feel about yourself. So it's fluid. It can change. And when you're willing to undermine both common sense and morality in such a profound way, in order to make that fly, you're also going to have to rewrite history. And so that's what this is all about. It's a rewriting of history in order to rebuild the moral foundation of, or actually to tear down the moral foundation of our culture and build an artificial, a different kind of morality, an amoral morality. And you just can't do that and appreciate the things in your culture. You see this, sadly, even in the church. I mean, it was at the MLK 50 conference earlier this year, sponsored by Together for the Gospel, where some panelists said that they were more confident that Martin Luther King was a genuine Christian than they were George Whitefield and Jonathan Edwards.
And, because they own slaves.
Right, because they, I don't know if they own slaves, but they defended slavery or whatever. They had a lax attitude. Well,
I think Whitefield did, and it had to do with his starting of schools,
right,
and having black people work at them. But it does appear that he owned them, although he also spoke out against the mistreatment of slaves. Look, it's not something that I would particularly care to defend.
Right.
What do we do with? Okay, let's take Whitefield for just a moment. Was he a total heretic? Is he the devil? Forget everything he said.
No. In fact, there maybe has not been a more clear preacher of the gospel in the post-Reformation era. He had the lung capacity and the theological clarity to really be the catalyst for the American Great Awakening, the first Great Awakening. But the point is, he preached the gospel. He believed the gospel. He may not have applied it consistently, and I think there are inconsistencies probably in all of us that won't be sorted out until we all get to heaven. But, I mean, Onesimus owned slaves too, because you go back to the New Testament, and the Apostle Paul didn't question his salvation over that, and in fact, he sent a runaway slave back to Onesimus. So this can't be the issue that determines whether a person's really saved or not. If you make something like that, anything like that, the issue, what you're doing is changing the gospel for a system of works and personal morality and all of that. On the other hand, Martin Luther King, whom they want to canonize, was well known for his impropriety with regard to sexual morality. He was unfaithful to his wife, at the very least, and there are stories about him and his behavior, stories told by his friends and supporters, not his enemies, that really bring into question the whole moral character of the man. But even more than that, and more important than that, he expressly and emphatically denied key aspects of the gospel. There were good things that King did with regard to civil rights, but you don't need to canonize him as a saint when, in fact, he was an apologist against the resurrection of Christ and the deity of Christ and the miracles of Scripture. He was a classic theological, I would say liberal, if not heavily influenced by the worst aspects of neo-orthodoxy. He was not a believer in the gospel. He argued against it. And as far as the record is concerned, he never once recanted that expressly and preached the gospel. So to say you're more confident that he's a true believer than someone who affirmed and believed the gospel is to turn truth on its head. And again, it's a similar kind of attempt, I think, just to rewrite history. I don't think anybody with any kind of biblical or theological legitimacy, a genuine commitment to the truth, would hold a position like that. But it was defended and doubled down on in, of all places, a conference sponsored by the Gospel Coalition. So none of that makes any sense to me. It's not only what's going on in secular culture that's troubling in this very sense, but this is happening in the church as well.
All right. That observation, setting that aside just for a moment, let me try to make this very personal because, Phil, I think this is pretty obvious. I'm sensitive and thoughtful. So let me just tussle this out a bit with you because I think that we need to somehow have a way to explain this. Let's just say for a moment that Martin Luther King Jr., his theology was fine. He was orthodox, but he was a scoundrel, the orgies, etc. George Whitefield, orthodox, owned slaves. How do we say, look, Martin Luther King isn't a guy that we would celebrate and remember, but George Whitefield is. How do we make that distinction and judgment?
I don't know that you need to. I think it's perfectly legitimate to affirm the good things that someone does and be critical of the bad things they do. There are men alive today whose teaching I generally would appreciate and benefit from, who do things or say things or hold positions that I can't affirm. And one of the real dysfunctional aspects of the attitude of public discourse today is things have become so politicized that if you criticize even one aspect of someone's teaching or belief or behavior, you're going to be accused of writing that person off completely. Well, why can't we affirm what's good, hold fast to what is good, and refute what is evil or erroneous? Why can't we do that? That's what Scripture commands us to do.
You see, Phil, this is why you make the big bucks, right there. It's this. I was presenting this as an either or. That's what progressives tend to do.
Right.
If somebody has anything in their closet, they're out of here. No. We've all got things in our closet. Look at the totality of the person's life. Speak well of the good things. Digest the things that are palatable and comment on the things that are not. So with Laura Ingalls Wilder, yes, she said things that we would not say today. I think we also need to remember regarding this issue, these people were a product of their times. If a little girl grew up in the Midwest being told that look out for those red-skinned natives, they want to scalp you, they want to tomahawk you, and she grew up being told that narrative, Well, you could understand why she might talk the way that she did. It doesn't justify it. But at least it gives it some historical context so that we don't have to dismiss the entire person if they've got a flaw.
Right. And I'm perfectly fine with being critical of the. I mean, let's face it, Laura Ingalls Wilder, I would never argue that she was a literary giant or that her writings are skilled representatives of great literature. There's a lot of stuff, not only in what she said, but how she wrote, that I would be critical of. But there's no need to write her off completely. That is a key part of American culture. And to be fair, too, you said this is what progressives do. It's not only the progressives. In the evangelical movement, in the most conservative wings, you've got one school of discernment, or at least that's what they call it, people who fancy themselves experts in discernment, who seem to live just to look for faults and flaws in well-known people. And if they find one tiny flaw, it doesn't matter how small it is, they'll write the guy off completely. Yeah. And they love to do that.
Right.
And that's folly.
Yeah, if you're going to call yourself a discernment ministry, you should be able to discern rightly. All right, that leads me to another subject that you talked about regarding the Gospel Coalition, MLK 50, perhaps the big evangelical story regarding the social justice movement issue that is still brewing would be the Tabiti Anyabwile Washington Post commentary that said, hey, my fellow evangelicals, you're selling your birthright for a bowl of pottage by partnering with Donald Trump and hoping that he'll nominate Supreme Court justices that overturn Roe v. Wade. I'm not sure. I'm paraphrasing. I'm not sure you're a Christian because you're not understanding other social issues, specifically racial reconciliation. It was a mind blower of an article. Phil, how am I to think of the author of that article?
Yeah, and that's a complex problem. I think in all candor that, and I've expressed this publicly before, so I'm not really saying anything that people don't already know, I'm concerned about the direction Tabiti has gone. I raised this issue a couple of years ago, quoting Tabiti himself, who said back in 2008, 2010, he did a couple of messages at Together for the Gospel that were excellent, where he said, look, if you find yourself, and I'm paraphrasing here, he didn't say this in these exact words, but the gist of his message was, look, if you find yourself always preaching about social issues and obsessed with social injustices and all that stuff, he said, you've gone off message. Mm-hmm. You've departed from the gospel. That's not the gospel. Let's stay with the gospel. I agree with the Tabiti of 2008 and 2010. The more recent stuff from him where he's hammering issues like this and raising doubts about people's salvation based on where they stand on his view of certain political and social issues, that is troublesome. And it's similar to a reflection of the very thing we're talking about, where there's a tendency today, I think, that when you find one disagreement with somebody, to just write that person off completely. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to do that with Tabiti. I mean, I've heard too many good messages, biblical messages, great biblical exposition from him. I love the man, and I love his biblical insights, but I think his political insights are dangerously wrong.
But at this season, because we're, you know, this, all these stories unfold, we don't need to make a decision of what we think is going to happen in a year. But at this present time, are we to esteem Tabiti Anyabwile as a brother or as a heretic?
Well, I count him as a brother, but there is a deeply troubling drift to some of the things he's been saying lately.
He's headed in a bad direction, but he's not over the... He hasn't apostatized. You know, Phil, I went to his church website. Do you know what statement of faith they adhere to at his church?
Probably the 1689 Baptist Confession.
Yeah, that's right. Right.
Which is, you know, essentially what I believe. There would be one or two issues in the 1689 Confession, really only one that I can think of, Sabbatarianism.
Yeah. So, I mean, it clearly theologically correct and sound, but on this particular issue, which is not an essential issue, it's demonstrating it's not a good trajectory. All right. Last subject, Mr. Johnson. We're not going to name the name because I believe when it comes to discernment, we shouldn't be making news about scandalous stories. We should only respond to them if we have something to contribute to them, if they are widely known, it's common knowledge, because I don't want to be spreading the story if it's not already spread. That's, I don't think that's the Christian's job. So for that reason, I'm not going to mention the name of the fellow who, within the last few days we saw, has had two moral failures and is no longer preaching in his pulpit. And the reason that this one is perhaps more shocking than any other fall we've seen is, I would have to say that I don't think we've seen anybody closer to our theological circle than this guy who has discredited himself and fallen from ministry. So this was a super troubling revelation. Phil, what are we to make of this when a guy who's spot on theologically preaches like an angel acts like a demon?
Yeah, I mean, I've been thinking about this lately because it's not just one. I mean, there's actually been a few moral failures over the past 5-6 years that would fit that exact description that you just gave. And it is troubling whenever it happens, and heartbreaking. It's sad. It just makes you want to weep. And yet,
I was sick.
Yeah. Ugh. And yet, there's a sense in which, and it's an important reminder that let him who thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall.
Yeah.
Scripture constantly reminds us that none of us is above that sort of moral failure. And in fact, I've always been fascinated by the Apostle Paul's candor as he talks about his own struggle with sin, particularly in Romans 7. He struggled with lust or covetousness of some kind, and he's confessing that. In another place, I forget exactly where it is, I think it's 1 Corinthians, he talks about his fear that he might become an outcast, a failure, that he might not finish the course correctly. So he clearly saw within himself still enough of the remnants of his own flesh and sin that he was disciplined to keep a watchful eye on himself, keeping his body set under control, lest those fleshly desires got out of control and caused him to fail. And if the Apostle Paul can be that aware of the possibility that he could ruin his entire ministry and void his whole testimony by falling into sin, then there's none of us that shouldn't take it seriously. Anyone who thinks, well, that could never happen to me, is probably standing on dangerous ground. And Scripture constantly gives us reminders of that. And that's how I think we ought to look at this and think of it. And thankful that in the instance I think you're talking about, the guy seems clearly repentant. He's doing the right thing by stepping down from ministry. I love him and wish him the best and pray that he will recover from this spiritually and that it won't ultimately destroy his faith. And it sadly has destroyed his reputation and the future of his ministry. And
Phil, a lot of people have been asking, it's a somewhat natural question, was that guy saved?
Yeah, see, I don't even ask that question. I don't have any reason to ask that question because he's repented. He's publicly confessed this, and that is how a saved person would respond to an instance like this. Look at David.
All right, but somebody would say, wait a second, though, a true believer doesn't do that. Now, we don't know the details, but let's face it, an adulterous relationship with two women is a big deal.
Yeah, well, there's truth in that. The right way to say that is not characteristic of a believer. But we know from Scripture that believers are capable of egregious sins. David, look at all that David did, not only adultery, but he covered it up for a year and committed an act that really would qualify as the guilt that it carries is the same as murder. He had her husband killed. It doesn't get any worse than that, right? And that was David, a man after God's own heart. And Scripture doesn't raise questions about whether he was a true believer or not. He clearly was.
Abraham,
look at Samson.
Another moral failure. Yeah. Look, Phil, I've always said that if my life were written about the way that characters, people in the Bible, their lives were written about, people would question my salvation. He does what?
Yeah.
When he's driving, he acts like at home, he's what? He thinks what? I don't know about that guy. So I think we better be careful.
Well, look at Lot. Lot's my favorite example because there's not one good thing about Lot in the Old Testament. But the New Testament assures us that he was a righteous man, that his soul was vexed by the sin that he was drawn to in Sodom. I mean, why did he move there? He felt some kind of comfort or at home there, and it wasn't easy to get him even to leave Sodom, and yet the New Testament tells us that his righteous soul was vexed by that. You know what? I kind of understand that. I understand that because it's my own experience. The very things that I sometimes feel a temptation to are things that vex my soul. And I think that's the struggle, the very struggle that Paul is describing in Romans 7. We need to take it seriously.
If nothing else from this tale, let it be a 5-alarm fire bell to wake us up from any spiritual stupor, to be watchful for our souls, and to work out our salvation with fear and trembling.
Philosophy, a hardbound collection of all the life lessons I've learned.
God is not a Gumby action figure that you can shape any way you want.
Phil, have you gone mental?
Act like men, not like girls.
I've got a real clear message for the two of you on that. Stop doing it.
How about we agree to argue until one of us actually refutes the other?
Are you kidding?